listener production. Hi, I'm Sasha Barbagat. Thanks for joining me on The Briefing. Can you imagine going to the doctor and then being forced to have the treatment they suggested? And I mean being restrained, forced to swallow pills, or have something injected into your arm. Imagine committing no crime, but still being detained, locked away, and losing your rights to make decisions to those of a psychiatrist.
Imagine being forced to take a medication with serious side effects that may not actually give you much benefit at all.
This is compulsory treatment, and in Australia, it's legal. You'll hear about it in the second half of today's episode. But first, the headlines with Katrina Blowers. It is Tuesday, the 30th of April.
Hi, Sasha. Hey, everyone. Well, we're starting today with grim new stats showing there was a 30% spike in women killed by intimate partners last financial year. So this data has been released by the Australian Institute of Criminology, and it shows that in 2022 to 23, 34 women were killed by a current or previous partner, and that is 8 more than in 2021-22. And of the 75 women who were murdered last year, just shy of half were killed by a male partner or ex. Intimate partner homicide is the most common form of homicide experienced by Australian women, but since 1990, it is worth pointing out that there has been a 66% decrease. Also, Sasha, First Nations people were far more likely to be the victims of homicide than non-Indigenous people, with a homicide victimisation rate around 7 times higher than that for non-Indigenous people.
The AIC, who published this data, says it's not clear what is causing the upward trend in the 12 months to June 2023. And these statistics come as pressure mounts on all levels of government to commit to ending the scourge of gendered violence against women. The states and territories will meet with the Prime Minister tomorrow for an emergency national cabinet meeting to discuss strategies. And Katrina, the Prime Minister's in a bit of hot water over his appearance at one of the rallies on Sunday in Canberra. And this has kind of been, I feel like, maybe overshadowing the conversation that we need to have. But I suppose on the other end of the spectrum, his comments, which I'll get to in a second, have been labelled as tone deaf because of the conversation we're having around how men treat women. So this all started when he appeared at the rally and he got on the microphone and he said he wasn't allowed to speak, but that he respected the decision of organisers. And we hear in the audio, which we'll play in a tick, that the organiser said that that was a lie.
We did ask to speak, myself and Katie, and we're told that that was impossible, and that's fine. I respect the organiser's right to do that.
That's a full-out lie.
Yeah, that was Sarah Williams there saying that was a full-out lie. So now there's this conversation happening around why the PM felt the need to get up and kind of point that out, who's telling the truth, and it's kind of gotten all a little bit messy, Katrina.
Yeah, and the other thing, you know, was whether Anthony Albanese said, I'm the Prime Minister, I run this country. Audio's been released that shows that he did in fact say, I'm the Prime Minister, but, you know, the part where he said, I run this country, before he got up and spoke, grabbed the microphone and spoke, people are saying that they heard it, but there's no audio to actually prove that. It is so sad because this is a really serious conversation that I feel we just keep having over and over and over again. And it's being hijacked right now by, quite frankly, a ridiculous argument. I actually don't care what Anthony Albanese said or not in the context of that protest. What I care is what he does and what the government does next.
The US is hopeful that Hamas will accept Israel's new ceasefire offer.
Hamas has before it a proposal that is extraordinarily generous. And in this moment, the only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas. They have to decide, and they have to decide quickly.
That was US Secretary of State Antony Blinken there speaking at the World Economic Forum in Saudi Arabia. So this proposal includes a 40-day truce and for potentially thousands of Palestinian prisoners to be freed in exchange for the release of Israeli hostages in Gaza.
Yeah, so this part is really interesting, Sasha, because for a long time now, Israel has demanded the release of at least 40 hostages. They've wanted women, older people, and those who are seriously ill to be released. They've wanted those 40 hostages, and they've said that number again and again in order to secure a new truce. Now we're hearing the Israeli government could be prepared to settle for only 33 hostages to be released in the first phase, which could expedite negotiations pretty dramatically and mean those talks could even start today. There are reports the proposal also involves new wording on restoring calm in a bid to meet Hamas's demands for a permanent ceasefire. The UK's Foreign Secretary David Cameron has also weighed in on the offer, saying all the eyes in the world should be on Hamas and urging them to take the deal. There's also growing pressure on the Israeli government to agree to a deal with families of hostages, and international allies calling for both a return of those still being held by Hamas and an end to violence in Gaza.
Yeah, and there's also an update out of Columbia University where there have been some pretty intense protests by students. They've been camping out. The university, Columbia University, has issued an order to those students to leave or face suspension. There's one happening at Sydney University, which I read about overnight, and there are up to 30 people currently camped out on the quadrangle at Sydney Uni in tents. They're being delivered food and supplies by apparently staff and other students, as well as people who are wanting to show their support. So this action at Columbia University has sparked similar kind of movements, not only in the US, but also here in Australia.
Do you remember the big Optus outage of 2022? Well, the federal government is going to force Australia's telcos to do better during outages. This all comes from the Bean Review, which was looking into the outage, which, let me refresh your memory, it lasted 12 hours. It impacted 10 million customers. So this review has made 18 recommendations, all of which have been accepted by the government. A number of these focused on 000 capabilities after Optus customers found themselves unable to even get in touch with police or fire and ambulance while services were down.
Oh, do I remember, Katrina? These recommendations will include forcing providers to give real-time updates to emergency services about what's happening, also making the telcos shut down their towers so that other networks can take over 000 calls, and establish what's called a 000 custodian, whose sole role will be to make sure the system is working. Also worth mentioning, Telstra's contract with the government to run the 000 system will also be reviewed, and any changes that are deemed necessary to make will be made in the next 12 months. And when it comes to customers, an industry-wide approach to responding to consumers affected by large-scale outages will be brought in, along with higher expectations when it comes to reporting future outages to the regulator.
I mean, this is all great, Sasha, and certainly a step in the right direction. I don't think anyone would argue that this wasn't the right thing to do, but my goodness, this happened back in 2022. I can't believe it has taken this long I know reviews take time, but this is pretty serious stuff that needed to be implemented.
Yeah, I think, we talk a lot about, how trigger-happy the government can be on reviews and inquiries and probes, but this is an example of why we put these reviews into place, because something wasn't working. Lots of things weren't working. 18 recommendations made in this report. So, we needed to get the clear picture and then implement those reviews. And the federal government's adopted all 18. So changes on the way.
And a bit of a gear shift now. We're going to be talking about something very visual in a podcast, which let's see how we go with that, hey? The Prince and Princess of Wales have released a previously unpublished photo from their wedding day. I don't think it's photoshopped. And this is all to mark their 13th wedding anniversary. So this is a really lovely black and white portrait showing the unfortunately much younger looking couple. I mean, Kate still looks kind of the same. William unfortunately had a lot more hair back then. They're standing together, smiling. Kate's holding her bouquet. William's in his military uniform. And the caption, which has been released by their photographer, that goes along with the image, reads 13 years ago today. So much happier times. A month after the princess revealed her cancer diagnosis, she's continuing to stay away from public duties as she gets treatment.
Yes, they did look much younger. And you're right, Kate still looks pretty great. Will's, not so much. Meantime, Harry and Meghan have announced they are going on tour. So the pair will travel to Nigeria after accepting an invitation from the country's highest ranking military official. And that will happen after Harry's trip to London for the Invictus Games 10th anniversary, which is happening next week. Meghan won't be joining him on that trip. Now, this story, I found the language interesting that they were going on tour. It sounds like very royal sort of, you know, they're going to participate in cultural activities and do all these meet and greets. And I'm kind of questioning why you'd leave the royal family if you're just going to spend your free time going on tours that sound pretty boring, I suppose.
Look, maybe there's a big jam market in Nigeria. I mean, Meghan Markle has just started that incredible business. What's it called? American Riviera Orchard. The worst name for jam ever, I believe. But who knows? Maybe she's seeing Nigeria as an untapped market for strawberry jam, and good on her if that's the case.
Yeah, great call. Katrina, thank you for being here for the headlines. Next up is Simon Beaton's chat about forced mental health treatment practices that are still legal in Australia.
It's been only a few short weeks since the Bondi Junction stabbing attacks, where tragically six people lost their lives. In the aftermath, as people have searched for answers, it has come to light that the attacker, 40-year-old Joel Cauchy, had been diagnosed with schizophrenia since the age of 17. According to Joel's parents, for a period of time in the lead-up to the attack, he had not been taking mental health medication. Currently in Australia, we have compulsory treatment laws, though the particulars change between the states and territories. Essentially, if a psychiatrist believes that you are at a severe risk of harming yourself or others, you can be forced to take medication or undergo treatment. But how subjective is that decision on labelling the risk? Research tells us patients with schizophrenia are less likely to be violent than the wider population. And if the medical practitioner gets it wrong, well, it means a loss of their rights and quite often incredibly strong and debilitating medication. Joining me to explain further is Dr. Kay Wilson from the University of Melbourne. Thanks for joining us on The Briefing. Explain to me what compulsory treatment actually means.
Okay, well, I think the first thing to say is that most people who have mental illness get treated voluntarily. There are situations where psychiatrists have powers under mental health legislation to detain people with a mental illness in hospital and to give them psychiatric treatment against their will. And when I talk about psychiatric treatment, what I'm really meaning is mostly medication. And that can be given to people compulsorily in hospital, but also in the community. And that's usually as a condition of their discharge from hospital.
I want to actually know a little bit more about that, because I think a lot of people, particularly young people, increasingly see therapists, psychologists, psychiatrists. Who actually has the power to enforce compulsory treatment? Could someone just say the wrong thing in their regular therapy session and suddenly find themselves detained?
Well, it's probably not just a case of saying the wrong thing. A psychiatrist will be using those powers after they're actually assessing people as having usually a severe mental illness. And there are some specific criteria that differ a little bit between the states, which must be met before they can do that, because it's quite a coercive power. So the first thing is they'll be looking to see if a person they think is at risk of harming themselves or others. And in some states, they might be required to see if the person is so unwell that they actually can't consent themselves. The other thing is, if they think a person's mental health is deteriorating, they might be able to act without having to wait to actually see that a person is at risk of harming themselves or others.
Wouldn't the analysis of risk that a patient poses to themselves or other, though, substantially change from one psychiatrist to another?
Well, yes. And the problem with the whole thing is, because it sort of sounds really logical, is that it's not really that easy to predict who's going to become violent or not, who's going to harm themselves or others. It's not really a precise science, and our studies indicate that the accuracy of psychiatric assessments is actually quite low. But what it means is that when doing that assessment, a psychiatrist might assess someone as being high risk, but that particular person may not and may never be violent. But at the same time, they might assess someone as perhaps being low or medium risk, And then that person will, you know, sort of slip through the net and go on and do something that's violent. The other issue is that when we sort of keep the focus of mental health law on dangerousness and preventing violence, it can sort of increase this discrimination against people with severe mental illnesses, because it kind of creates this false impression that all people with mental illness are violent, which is completely incorrect.
Is there a chance that compulsory treatment is being enforced perhaps in a lot of situations where it shouldn't be?
So there are a group of people who are mental health disability advocates and some international human rights bodies, like the Committee for the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, who are responsible for monitoring that convention. And they're very much of the view that the government should never, ever be able to involuntarily detain and treat people with mental illness at all. And there are reasons for that view. I'm not one of them. I'm probably more about thinking that we need to perhaps find the right balance. So you've got that sort of group. And then obviously sometimes you get other groups, and especially when something like the Bondi Junction stabbings happen, that people start to panic in the media and the public, and there's this danger that we can get these cries of people saying, you know, we're feeling really unsafe, we need to start, you know, tightening compulsory treatment, and we should start locking more people up, which isn't something that will necessarily make everyone safer, because it's hard to predict exactly who might go on to be violent. So, yeah, there's lots of different views about whether we get the balance right under mental health law.
On that note, I spoke to Pat McGorry last week, who is the CEO of Origin, a youth mental health organisation, and he was past president of the Schizophrenia International Research Society. And I'd like to play you a bit of that audio right now.
So they ended up getting what's called episodes of care, which might last from a few days or weeks, either in hospital or in the community. And as soon as they settle, like this boy, they get flicked back to the GP, and primary care is not what it used to be either.
Yeah,
so
right.
The GP is somehow expected to monitor this person and pick up when they're becoming unwell. And often when they are becoming unwell, they don't turn up for GP appointments. The GPs don't chase them, can't chase them. So there's no safety net.
So it sounds to me that we're not supporting the people who need to be caught by that safety net, but then we're also enforcing treatment for people in ways that quite often might not help lead them to recovery. Have I got this right?
Oh, look, that's a really complicated question, and it's really difficult, because if someone then becomes a voluntary patient, normally we don't monitor them. And that's not just for psychiatry, it's just for all healthcare. So every time we set up a system where we're monitoring people, that on the one hand, it's saying, well, we're giving them support, we're keeping an eye on them. On the other hand, it's also setting up, I guess, a system of surveillance that, is very ongoing. So it has civil liberties implications as well. Really, there's just no really easy answers with mental health policy, because there's this kind of situation where it can become a circular problem, which is what Patrick McGorry was talking about. What I haven't really talked about is that a lot of people who have compulsory treatment, they report it as being very traumatizing, especially if they have seclusion, which involves being isolated, or being restrained, which can be physical, it can be chemical, and it can be mechanical in terms of, being tied up, essentially. When people come out of that and they feel like, being in hospital wasn't a healing experience for them, that it was underfunded, that it sort of was a bit of a prison-like environment, that they felt unsafe, that they weren't listened to, that it made them worse, what happens is that if they think, and it was ineffective, that kind of creates this cycle where people are like, oh, I'm never going back there. And they're actively trying to avoid treatment, and it's hard to keep an eye on that.
Do we know how many people statistically are resistant to compulsory treatment because of those reasons, like the medication that they're going to be on, restrained, not having control, not having power over their own lives, versus those who are refusing it because they aren't necessarily in the right headspace? Or is that too hard to know?
No, there's been studies about this, looking retrospectively, asking people how they felt about their compulsory treatment. And it's sort of roughly, we'd say, there's probably about a third who are actually very, very angry about it and who feel like their rights were completely violated. there's probably roughly another sort of 30 to 40% who are like, well, I agree that I probably did need it, but did they have to do it the way they did it? You know, it was just, it was a violent experience, and I was traumatized by it, and they didn't have to, you know, throw me on the ground and restrain me. And then there's probably about another third or so who feel that it was needed and they are grateful for having the intervention.
Kay, tell me about the medication that a lot of patients are being put under for compulsory treatment of serious mental health conditions.
Because I think that's a really important question, because I think it can be difficult for outsiders to understand why some people might not want to take their medication and get well. You know, the way it's talked about is, why can't they just stay on their meds? So they just, it's as though they're just being naughty. And I think it's important for people to understand that, you know, many psychiatric medications, especially the ones for schizophrenia, have quite serious and, you know, sometimes permanent side effects. So things like shaking, muscle spasms and twitching, weight gain, drooling, sexual dysfunction, heavy sedation, and just a sort of dulling of the senses. So they might dampen down the psychosis and those symptoms, but they also just dampen down everything else. So people feel like maybe they're not themselves anymore, and they report feeling that life is just less enjoyable, even little things in life. And then on top of that, we know that from probably up to about 60% of people with mental illness are described as being treatment resistant. So for them, the medication isn't even working that well. So imagine being forced to take a medication with serious side effects that may not actually give you much benefit at all.
And one last question, which I feel like you're not going to like, but what is the solution? Like, obviously, compulsory treatment is flawed. Yet, as you've kind of mentioned, for someone who is a high risk for the safety or themselves and others, it may be necessary in some capacity. What do we do? How do we make this better and safer for everyone, patients and the public?
I think probably one thing is to perhaps realise that as much as we might really want to, it may not be possible to prevent all acts of violence, which is why we have a criminal justice system to deal with that. You know, people can be violent for many reasons, not just mental illness. But I think what also we can do is to, you know, repair our severely underfunded and understaffed mental health system and follow the recommendations of recent inquiries like the Productivity Commission inquiry and the Royal Commission into Victoria's mental health system. We need to improve services, perhaps try to shift away from coercion so it becomes a last resort. Also, some of my work is looking at things from a big picture perspective. So looking at all the social and environmental stresses that we know contribute to mental ill health. They're called the social determinants of health and mental health. And thinking about how we can use those to try to prevent people from becoming ill in the first place.
Yeah, some wise words. Thank you so much for joining us on The Briefing, Dr. Kay.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Dr. Kay Wilson from the University of Melbourne. And that is all that we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back again this afternoon from 3 p.m. with another episode. And if you did find that chat interesting, please do share it around with a friend or family member and make sure you hit follow so you never miss anything from us ever at all. My name is Simon Beaton. See you soon.
Listener.